Court will hear arguments first this morning in Commissioner of Internal Revenue against Tufts. Mr. Smith, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This federal income tax case comes here on a writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Presents an important question dealing with the tax consequences of the disposition of property subject to a mortgage. The Court of Appeals in this case allowed a loss based upon a cost that respondents did not incur and turned out never would incur, and thereby reached a result that we believe to be totally at odds with the economic reality of the transaction. The facts are relatively simple and can be summarized as follows. In 1970, respondents formed a general partnership for the construction of an apartment project in Duncanville, Texas. They obtained a non-recourse mortgage loan of $1.85 million. By non-recourse, that meant that none of the borrowers on the note bore any personal liability for the loan, but that the lender bank could look only to the security of the property secured by the mortgage. In 1971 and 1972, the partners, of which Mr. Tufts was one, contributed approximately $40,000 in cash to the general partnership. And they included, under the applicable tax rules, which parties stipulate to be correct, a proportionate share of their $1.85 million debt in each of their bases of their partnership interests. In 1970 through 1972, when the partners held the project, they claimed approximately $440,000 of the tax deductions, which represented depreciation and other losses in connection with the operation of the apartment project. Those deductions were entirely proper and are not at issue in this case. In August 1972, the partners disposed of the property subject to the mortgage to an unrelated third party. At the time of this disposition, there never had been any amortization of the principal balance on the mortgage debt. That mortgage debt remained throughout the entire period of their ownership at $1.85 million. And at the time of disposition, the basis of the taxpayers' partnership interest had been reduced because of depreciation to $1.45 million. Now, this transaction came under audit by the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, and he determined that respondents had realized gain of approximately $400,000 as a result of the disposition of the property. The computation of gain was by reference to the amount realized by the respondents in this case, the $1.85 million loan which the unrelated party picked up on the transfer of the property subject to the mortgage, minus their bases of $1.45 million, which yields approximately $400,000 in gain. This case came to the tax court on respondents' petition for review, and the tax court upheld the commissioner's determination and in so doing followed a uniform line of authority of both the tax court and of the other appellate courts, and in a situation like this, a disposition of property subject to a mortgage requires that when the mortgage has never been amortized down at all, that the amount realized on the disposition of property include the unpaid mortgage balance. The Court of Appeals, however, in this case, reversed. It limited the amount realized to the value of the property that happened to be at the time of disposition, which was $1.4 million. And it did so despite the fact that the property was transferred subject to a debt well in excess of this amount, that is $1.85 million. But the value of the property we submit has absolutely no significance to the tax consequences of such a transaction. As I shall develop, once the taxpayers determine to transfer the property along with the debt, the value of the property is only of relevance to the new owner and the lender, who must look to that value of the property for satisfaction of his loan.
Mr. Smith, isn't what the Court of Appeals did quite consistent with the intimation in the Crane footnote?
No, we don't. No, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, we don't think it is consistent with the intimation in the Crane footnote. As I shall point out in greater detail, all we think that Crane footnote did was to, by way of dictum, express a reservation that they weren't dealing with the facts of the case that is now before the court. I don't think that the intimation in that footnote is necessarily tantamount to a rule of law that when the value of the property...
I agree with you, but how much practice and usage among the tax bar and courts that decide tax cases more often than we has grown up in reliance on the idea that what you would describe as a dictum is at least good?
Absolutely not. The practice and usage is directly to the contrary. I think that it's fair to say that the tax bar, both public and private, has always regarded that footnote, as I shall point out in greater detail, as simply a response to the economic benefit analysis that the court engaged in part in Craig. But we submit, and the courts of appeals, apart from the court below, as well as the tax court, has consistently held, both before Crane and since Crane, that the fundamental aspect of the Crane principle is the relationship, the functional relationship between basis and amount realized. And basically, our submission here is that since that basis is cost, and it requires that implies an economic outlay. And in this particular case, the respondents borrowed $1.85 million on a non-recourse basis. Crane, the principle of Crane, allows you to include that loan balance in basis for purposes of depreciation or any other purpose, purposes of computing gain on ultimate disposition. But the quid pro quo of including that in basis is that at the other end of the transaction, that mortgage balance has never been paid, you have to account for it at the other end of the transaction. In other words, the notion is that basis is economic outlay, that is cost. And while we permit someone to borrow money and count it as basis, if they never pay any of that money, there has to be a reconciliation of the accounts at the other end. The footnote in Crane didn't dispute what we think is the logic of that. And in fact, the Crane decision, the rationale of the Crane decision we submit, that is, establishing a functional relationship between basis and amount realized requires that there be this reconciliation of accounts at the disposition of property the way occurred in this case.
Why do you think footnote 37 is there?
I think footnote, there's been a lot of ink spilled on this, Mr. Justice Blackmun, and I could only perhaps summarize it in a few sentences. I suspect that the reason footnote 37 is there, I think what happened in Crane is that the court engaged in part in what the commentaries refer to as an economic benefit analysis. And one of the things that the Chief Justice wrote was, Mrs. Crane got some kind of economic benefit. And in so doing that, what the court, in order to arrive at that result, the court had to equate her non-recourse mortgage with some sort of recourse liability. And it was able to do this because she conceded in the case that if the amount had been recourse, if the liability had been recourse, of course she would have been required to take it into account. But she strenuously urged that the non-recourse aspect of the debt made the case different. Well, what the court said was, that wasn't really true in this particular case because the value of the property exceeded the mortgage balance. So in a situation like that, the court equated recourse and non-recourse debt. And then because of this aspect of the analysis, the court wanted to indicate that perhaps that wouldn't be the case that aspect of the analysis wouldn't apply if the value, if the numbers were reversed. But I think that everyone since that time has indicated that the economic benefit analysis of Crane is really not the heart of Crane. And it's not the, that the Crane principle stands on the logical bedrock of a relationship between basis and amount realized, and that if the code permits you to be deemed to have made an economic outlay, and you get basis for this outlay, even though you've borrowed funds and you haven't actually put a dime out of your pocket, but implicit in that notion is that you will ultimately pay some money. And if you don't ultimately pay some money the way respondents did in this case, well, then there has to be a reconciliation. And in fact, in thinking about this case, it seemed to me, if you sort of strip it of all its essentials, what it really boils down to is, suppose one were to buy a suit from a department store and charge it for $200. And then you wear it a couple of times.
Now you're at a level we understand.
And it doesn't fit you anymore. Perhaps the excesses of the holiday season. But you have a brother-in-law who's actually much slimmer, and he likes the suit, and he said, I haven't paid the bill yet, and he said, well, give me the bill and I'll pay it, and I'll take the suit off your hands. At that time, the suit is worth $100 because it's not a new suit anymore. Well, under the Court of Appeals rationale, which limits amount realized to value, you would have $100 loss, putting aside the question as to whether you could deduct a suit.
That isn't quite fair, because he owed the bill for the suit.
Sure, but under our system, recourse, since
everybody Crane agrees, everybody agrees you realize an amount if you have one of your obligations assumed.
Well, but, Mr. Justice White, under our system, since Crane, we've been equating recourse and non-recourse liabilities. The example is not exact, but I think
You're just bootstrapping. You're saying the Crane principle just covers this case like a blanket, even though it was reserved.
I'm suggesting, and I think that the decisional laws, apart from the decision in this case, is uniformly to the effect that really the reservation in the case only dealt with the economic benefit aspect of the analysis.
You're bound to get around to saying why did this seller realize anything?
What did he
realize? You've got to determine what amount he realized.
Right. We say he realized $1.8 million.
And why?
He realized $1.8 million because he borrowed $1.8 million. The code gave him basis for that.
Yes.
At the other end of the transaction, he had not amortized that he had not paid out one bit, and somebody else is going to pay that debt. The property goes along with the debt. And at that point, the tax law has to say, well, how do we reconcile these accounts? We've been assuming, we've given you basis during the stewardship of your ownership on the assumption that you were going to pay out something.
So what you're really saying is that he realized something when he took the deduction.
Well, I don't think I'm really saying that because...
You want to get it back anyway. We don't want to get the deductions back,
and in fact, you're going to
pay gain on the.
Well, I think the response to that is that the numbers here are fairly comparable, given the fact that the property is practically 100% financed, and the debt has not been amortized one penny. In a situation like that, of course, there's going to be a rough comparability between the deductions taken, which represent, quote, a recovery of capital, so to speak.
Mr. Smith, suppose there'd been no deductions taken at all, what would your position be?
Be exactly the same. Be exactly the same. And in fact,
would there be any gain realized? And if so, what would it be?
Well, I suppose if there were no deductions taken, there would be no. Then in that case, the taxpayers' partnership bases would be $1.85 million.
Yeah.
And his amount realized would be $1.85 million, in which case there would be no gain or loss.
So you are saying that the deductions constitute the gain. In effect.
Well, we don't think in a rough way, but we're not. But let me emphasize the fact that we're not recapturing deductions, and I think that the best way to illustrate this is by assuming that there were no deductions, and that, for example, let's assume that the property in this case was non-depreciable. Suppose the property was just a parcel of raw land, which they got a $1.85 million non-recourse note. We set this out in our brief and in our reply brief as well. The property then declines to $1.4 million, as occurred in this case. The partners then can't make a go of it. They transfer the property subject to a mortgage. Under the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, and I don't think there can be any quarrel about that, the respondents would have a $400,000 loss because their basis would be 1.85 and their amount realized would be 1.4. Now, it is absolutely bizarre, to say the least, how people in a situation like that could have a $400,000 loss. They haven't expended a single penny. In fact, in this particular case, the error of the court below, it seems to us, is confirmed by the fact that the Court of Appeals gave the respondents an extra $50,000 of loss. That is equal to the difference between their $1.45 million basis and the $1.4 million fair market value. This is the modern equivalent of the miracle of the loaves and the fishes. How can there be a loss here? And in fact, the respondents no longer have the temerity even to claim that loss, although they did claim it in the courts below. And their support of the decision below necessarily supports the rationale that upholds such a loss. In our view, this is an aberration that doesn't fit with Crane and doesn't really fit with anything logical that one can imagine the code to
Mr.
allow.
Mr. Smith, why wouldn't the approach taken by the amicus Barnett solve your problem?
It would solve the problem to an extent, Justice O'Connor, but our response to that simply is that over the last 45 years, property transferred with liabilities has always been considered by the Treasury to be transfers of the property along with the liability. We don't bifurcate these things in that way.
You take the position that the Treasury Department could subsequently decide to approach it exactly that way, that that's within the framework of the
statute? I think it would be a radical transformation. I think it would be contrary to all the assumptions that have proceeded from this Court's Crane case.
Would it be consistent with the statutory structure? To take that.
One can read the statute the way the amicus reads the statute. However, the Treasury has for the last 50 years read the statute to impose capital gains in a situation like this one. And we feel that the Treasury's reading of the statute is a permissible one, and given the fact, the deference that such administrative constructions are given to by the courts in general and by this court, we feel that the proper result here is the imposition of capital gains on the $400,000.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. If the purchaser here had paid the taxpayer $1.4 million in cash for this property, free and clear,
mm-hmm.
and the taxpayer had then taken that $1.4 million and paid the secured party the 1.4 in full satisfaction of the $1.8 million debt, I assume you would recognize then that the amount realized on the property was the $1.4 million, not the $1.8.
No, I think
no?
It would still be $1.8. Essentially, and in fact, it seems to me that the income there, there's obviously gain in a situation like that. When you discharge a $1.8 million liability with a $1.4 million piece of property, Our view is that.
But it doesn't occur on the sale of the property, does it?
Well, but it's part and parcel of. I mean, I think the commission would take the position that since the liability secured the debt, it's part and parcel of the same thing, without meaning to make a pun. And that would still be. I mean, there's obviously, in your example, still gain. The amicus would take the position that it was gain from cancellation of indebtedness would be ordinary income. But the important thing, it seems to us, the significance that I draw from the amicus presentation is that we both agree that there's gain in a transaction like this. It seems to us that the consistent administrative position as to the kind of gain it is from Crane and from all the cases like Millar have always been capital gain and not ordinary income. I cannot say that there cannot be a situation where the two transactions, the liability aspect of the transaction and the asset aspect of the transaction, might be so separate and unrelated that there might be a determination of ordinary income. But this case before the court is not such a case. The commission's determination of capital gain, we think, is correct.
The professor would give you more than you ask for.
The professor would give us more than we ask for. That is true.
Let me ask you one other question about Crane, and that is that, so I'm sure that I know your position. Do you feel that this case can be affirmed without overruling Crane?
No. We think that
Leaving footnote 37 aside, I take it then that it is your position that Crane controls this case.
That the rationale and teaching of Crane controls this case. And that the Court of Appeals, in fact, if there need be any evidence of that, it's the fact that the Court of Appeals explicitly denied a connection between basis and amount realized. I think it's on page 35A, note 9 of the appendix. Court of Appeals said there is simply no relationship between basis, adjustments to basis, and amount realized. And Crane establishes a functional relationship. I cannot see any more disparate views, more contrary views. It seems to us that the logic of the decision below cannot be squared with what Crane held, and what it seems to us that all responsible practitioners, both of the public and private tax bar, have assumed that Crane is held.
May I ask you one question about your position as applied to Crane itself? Supposing on the facts of Crane where you have inherited property, the property had been disposed of at a time when its fair market value was below the amount of indebtedness, you would still say there that the heir would have a full gain as to the extent of the indebtedness. The measure, you would apply, Crane itself, you would say, would have been decided the same way if the property.
Exactly. And then they would have had to have faced up. There wouldn't have been a footnote 37. And we wouldn't
have. I wouldn't be standing here
because presumably all of this would have been solved. The problem simply is that there are a lot of strands in Crane. Although Crane,
but your Loaves and Fishes argument is not very persuasive when you have inherited property. Is it? Someone inherits property and inherits no obligation, but the property is encumbered, and then they dispose of it by just abandoning it. They suddenly realize a gain in the amount of the encumbrance under your view.
Right. Although tax lawyers have no problems with that sort of thing, only because. But the point is that if you get basis in something, then there has to be a reconciliation at the other end.
And maybe tax lawyers don't, but taxpayers do, wouldn't you say?
That's true. That's true. Although we think in this particular case where the concept of basis requires an economic outlay either now or sometime, here where the respondents have paid not a penny, other than the small cash contributions that they've made to the partnership, it seems absolutely anomalous, to say the least, that they could that they could achieve permanent exclusion of $400,000 of gain. This is not simply deferral in this context. This is permanent exclusion of gain.
Now, the basis that the purchaser has in this property is only $1.4 million?
Yes, that is true, Justice O'Connor. And the reason for that is simply that the Internal Revenue Service has, I think, soundly taken the position that when value of property is way below a non-recourse debt. There have been a lot of tax shelter activity in which the non-recourse debt bears no relationship to the property. Under those circumstances, the Internal Revenue Service has taken the position that at the very most, you get basis equal to the value of the property.
It's just a little hard to understand how the basis of the property would be the lower figure, but what the seller received is a higher figure.
Well, I don't think it really is hard to understand if one looks at it from the seller's point of view. The seller put $1.8 million in his pocket. He then bought this building. The fact that it declined in value has absolutely no significance to him economically if he does, transfer the property along with the debt, so that the debt is of no interest to him. And the value of the property is of no interest to him. It really is very much like the suit in the department store. You're just not interested in the whole transaction anymore. But what the Court of Appeals would say here is that your amount realized is $1.4 million. Now, how is it possible for you to have a $400,000 loss in a situation like that when you haven't expended a penny? And going back to my example, I got off on a tangent when we were talking about depreciation, Mr. Justice Powell. In answer to your question, if the property had just been raw land, there would be a $400,000 loss. And there would be no loss in a situation like that. There's been no economic expenditure. The taxpayers here are not poorer by a penny. And in our view, that fact glaringly calls for the reversal of the judgment.
May I ask one other question? Am I correct in understanding that, under your view, the basis for the transferee, in this case Bales, is limited by the fair market value? So his basis is different from the amount realized.
His basis is $1.4 million.
So that what you're saying is if fair market value puts a ceiling on it, then it puts a ceiling on at both ends of the transaction. If the amount of the indebtedness is the major basis, it is at both ends of the transaction.
Well, the reason for that at the Bales end of the transaction is simply because, and there's case law to support this, that when the value of property is greatly, it is a great disparity between that and non-recourse debt, that basis ought not to be the value of the non-recourse debt, because it's almost like not real debt in the sense that there's only a fanciful aspect of that it'll ever be paid, very much like a contingent debt. And the courts have uniformly rejected inclusions of basis in that.
So going back to my Crane question earlier, if the value of the property at the time of the death of the person from whom it was inherited had a fair market value of less than the indebtedness, that would have been her basis at the time.
Yeah.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Let me start by setting at rest a couple of questions that Mr. Smith has raised. First, we agree there should be no deductible loss without economic detriment. Similarly, there should be no taxable gain without economic benefit. The way the tax system deals with this is to say there may be loss realized but not recognized and not allowed. And we agree with counsel for the government that the taxpayers did not suffer a deductible loss in a situation where they suffered no economic detriment. And the cases consistently so hold. So that to the extent the government contends that is an issue in this case, we have not raised that issue except in the tax court.
Well, I was going to say, has your position been consistent on that all the way through?
Your Honor, we raised the issue at the opening of the tax court case. We lost in the tax court. We did not raise it in the Fifth Circuit, and it was not ruled on by the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit did not hold that we had a deductible loss.
So your position has not been consistent all the way through?
No, Your Honor. It was not consistent in the tax court below. We have tried to abandon that issue consistently by letters and representations and statements to the government, but now that they find it the strongest handle they have to waggle at us, they waggle it at us again and again.
Well,
we agree.
Like
there is no deductible loss.
I'd like to waggle it at you, too, because it seems to me that if the statute, you just read the words, the definition of amount realized and all the rest of it, how can it have one meaning in the loss situation and a different meaning when you're looking at the amount realized where there's a claim to be a gain?
Because losses and deductions are a matter of legislative grace. They are not given to taxpayers unless the Internal Revenue Code allows it.
Well,
income, on the other hand, is constitutionally taxed, and we pay taxes on virtually all income.
But even if it's a matter of legislative grace, and maybe you don't want it in this case, but the next taxpayer who comes along and says, well, if these words mean what the Fifth Circuit said they mean in this case, we're entitled to take the loss. And why wouldn't that be correct?
Because there is no economic detriment.
But what in the statute requires an economic detriment?
Section 165 of the Internal Revenue Code says that losses shall be allowed unless compensated for by insurance or otherwise. It's our feeling that the or otherwise constitutes a broad range of negative economic effect. That is, any time the taxpayer doesn't truly suffer the loss, and the insurance analogy I think is very strong. When our car is damaged, we suffer a loss, but we're not allowed to deduct it because the insurance company reimburses us for it. But the loss has been suffered, just as I think the government's illustration of a piece of property that we own going down in value from $1.8 million to $1.4 million. I think a loss has occurred. I think something has happened in the world that shrinks the assets of the world by $400,000. So I think to say there's no loss begs the question. To go further and say that we will manipulate the Internal Revenue Code to prove there's no loss by increasing the amount realized on this $1.4 million piece of property, we therefore demonstrate there's no loss. Now, that to me is the ultimate of alchemy, because the loss really has been suffered. It's not deductible because the taxpayer has not suffered a true economic detriment. The cases say that in situations like that, taxpayers are not allowed to deduct a loss, even though the loss is experienced, is suffered, is realized.
Well, you say somebody maybe, by the depreciation of the property, somebody has suffered a loss, but is it the taxpayer if he hasn't suffered any economic harm?
No.
It's probably the bank.
Probably.
But it isn't the taxpayer's loss.
Clearly not. Therefore, no deductible loss.
Let me put this hypothetical to you. I assume you'd agree that it would make no difference if this were a partnership or an individual.
I would prefer to reserve. Actually, it should make a difference, sir.
Let's assume, to simplify the hypothetical, it's an individual, and the transaction is exactly the same. Now the taxpayer is making up a statement for his bank before this transaction occurred, that is, after he'd acquired the property, before disposing. And then assume after the transaction is completed, he makes up a financial statement for the bank for other purposes. Can you suggest how the transaction would be treated in terms of assets and liabilities and his financial statement?
Well, he certainly has suffered. He has realized no gain. That is to say, he is not a richer man by having disposed of the property.
In the first place, he wouldn't list this liability
exactly
as a liability on his first statement because it was non-recourse.
Exactly.
Do you agree?
Yes, sir.
Now, after the transaction is completed, would you make that comparison for me?
Well, actually, I think at the start of the transaction, there would be balancing entries. That is, there would be an asset and a liability in equal amount, whatever those amounts were, $1.8 million of asset and $1.8 million of liability. On the disposition of the asset, both would disappear from his balance sheet. Now, that is the simple fact of it. His assets are not enriched. That is, we don't have $400,000 of assets freed up by virtue of the disposition of the property, which would have been the case had this been liability debt. That is to say, if there had been cancellation of $400,000 of liability debt, then other assets, stocks, bonds, and cash, would have been freed up, and he would have had gain. But in a situation like this, it's as though the man owned only one asset and owed only one debt.
Well, in the Chief Justice example, though, when you're making up your statement to the bank after you purchase the property and build the building and complete the loan and you close it, but this is before the sale, before you sell. How do you enter it on your balance sheet?
I would say we have $1.8 million asset and $1.8 million of liability.
Well, he doesn't owe the liability. The property is subject to it, so it reduces his asset.
Well, are you saying, sir, that it would be appropriate to say zero asset because it's on
asking you. What do you think?
I'm free of any misconceptions because I'm not an accountant. I know that
accountant, though.
the accountants, you know, when faced with this situation, say, my goodness, if something has happened on the left side, we must act on the right side. The answer that I give is that this is federal taxation. This is not double entry bookkeeping. That the tax system very often allows entries on the left side with no effect on the right side. We give a lot of deductions in the oil industry, for example, that are never offset anywhere else in the system. And notwithstanding Mr. Smith's statement, there is, in many situations, no reconciliation of cost basis. We get cost basis in a number of situations that don't require that we give it back later on. For example, in the case of individuals who go through bankruptcy, we have cancellation of debt, we have no income, and yet that debt may well have produced deductions. It may well have acquired assets that produce depreciation deductions. We don't go back and recapture it. Notwithstanding what Mr. Smith says, the Crane case did not hold that anything included in basis must find its way into amount realized. The only reference to functional relationship was a common definition of property. What the court was saying was, property must mean the same thing in the basis section as property means in the amount realized section because we use these two concepts in computing gain. Therefore, we must use apples and apples. But it didn't. They were not saying that anything that's included in basis must find its way into amount realized because they are not related. Because basis is cost in one section, the situation, or basis is value. In Mrs. Crane's situation, there was no cost element.
Mr. Mankoff, in the corporate reorganization context, I assume you would concede, though, that the cancellation of the indebtedness is the amount received for tax purposes under sections 357C and 358.
357C, which has to do with the contribution of assets subject to liability, does not appear to have a limitation on it based upon the value of assets. As indicated in the brief, however, 311C, which describes assets coming out of a corporation, does have that kind of limitation. I don't know why there's an inconsistency. Generally, the code and the courts have treated fair market value and economic benefit as being real concepts that must be part of our tax system, because without them, we don't have a touchstone with which to measure the consistency and fairness of our system.
May I ask you a question? Supposing we have a transaction similar to this, but before the owner of the property disposed of it, they realized the fair market value declined from $1.8 million to $1.4 million, and the owner went to the bank and said, we can't carry the $1.8 million loan. Would you reduce the indebtedness to a more realistic figure? And they agreed to reduce the indebtedness, say, to $1.5 million. Then he continued to own it for a while. But he never is on the note. Would he realize any tax? Would there be any taxable consequences in changing the principal amount of the note when it's a non-recourse note?
I would say first there should be no immediate tax consequence. No. I think very often that's treated as an adjustment of the purchase price. If you're talking about the seller, in the situation you're describing, talking about the bank, I don't think it would be treated as adjustment of sale price, and clearly there would be no tax at that time, no.
And then suppose they did that, and then after owning it for 2 or 3 years, then after another year or so, then he disposed of it, as he did in this case, fair market value at $1.5 million. You would say in that case, what would be the tax?
We have exactly the situation we have here, which is there is no gain realized without economic
benefit. Even though the liability was reduced in amount, that still didn't result in any taxable benefit of any kind to the owner of the property who was not on the note.
Not if he's not liable for the note, Your Honor. So, this gets back to what Crane was talking about. The question was asked, must we overrule Crane in order to affirm the Fifth Circuit? And the answer is no. Crane dealt with only those situations which resembled recourse debt. They properly announced the law as to recourse debt and said that where non-recourse debt fits that same situation, then we're going to apply the recourse debt rule. And I understand what the court was saying. I, notwithstanding the government's inability to understand this concept, I own some property subject to non-recourse debt. It has a value higher than that mortgage, and I treat it as though I owe that debt every penny of it. And I will pay that debt rather than lose that property. And that's all the court was saying in Crane, that in a case where the non-recourse debt is going to be treated as recourse debt, there's nothing wrong with treating the entire situation as though there was liability. But they did say this will, this probably is not the rule, obviously is not the rule, where you don't have a similarity of situation, where you have a situation where an individual will not treat the debt of it as his own, then it should not be treated the same because we don't have economic benefit, we don't have any advantage to the taxpayer. Certainly our system is based upon that. At no time was the Crane Court saying that there must be an inclusion or a paying up at the end of a transaction for the advantage of utilizing basis or cost. Because, you know, mortgage debt was not really in Mrs. Crane's cost as such. Her cost was the value of the property. It happened, the court said, the value of the property is the total property, unreduced by any debt. And so we're not talking here or in Crane about a situation where we must replace that at the end of the transaction. All the court was saying was that where there is a similarity and a resemblance that will cause people to treat these transactions identically, then there's nothing inappropriate about the tax consequences being identical. And if we, a similar situation, if we were at risk in this transaction, so that we were in default and a foreclosure sale occurred and a third party bought in this property at $1.4 million, and the bank then said to us, well, we want the other $400,000, and we said, well, we'll try to get it for you. Certainly no one would say at that moment that we had any gain in excess of $1.4 million. No one would talk to us about the depreciation deductions we had enjoyed in years past. No one would talk to us about the necessity of the quid pro quo, if you please, of replacing that the cost basis incident to mortgage. We haven't yet paid it. We may pay it in the future or we may not. But in that taxable year, certainly no one would talk of a tax consequence, including that as part of our gain. And why should someone who is in a non-recourse position be treated less favorably than someone who owes the debt?
I'm not sure, Mr. Hancock, whether you hadn't completed your response to my hypothetical or whether you did complete it and I didn't follow you. What's the difference in these two statements in terms of the net worth of this individual in the hypothetical, before and after?
Mr. Chief Justice, in my opinion,
if you're making net worth, the statement for him, how would you make it up?
Yes. I would make it up as showing a liability and an asset in identical amount.
In the first statement.
That's right, in the first statement. And I would then show a cancellation of both items on the disposition of the property. Period. I can't conceive.
He's neither richer nor poorer.
Exactly. Exactly. It's as though the man owned no other assets. Yes. He is neither richer nor poorer. He has used all of the assets available to pay this debt to pay this debt. He has walked away from the transaction with nothing that he didn't have before.
But, of course, on the first statement, he has no personal liability for the obligation, does he?
No, he does not.
Well, what if his income from the property, though, the rental income from the property, just paid, was such that he didn't earn any income, but he had a cash flow equal, a net cash flow that he could put in his pocket equal to the depreciation?
He would have gross income measured by the rental income. He would have a deduction equal to the depreciation deduction.
Yes, and he would have cash then that he didn't have before.
Yes, that'd be relevant to the rental income.
Yes, and so that he would have a he would walk away from the transaction with that with the with money equal to the amount of the deductions.
He would also have, if I may submit.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
He'd have that much more money afterwards than he had before.
Yes, That is absolutely correct. All right. This is the transaction in 1970 and 1971. This is the transaction to which the government has no complaint. And their question now is...
Well, I know, but that's the very amount of money that they would like to tax now.
The question then becomes, can we rewrite Section 1001B to correct earlier undeserved deductions? I think the answer is clearly no. The amount realized definition has never been rewritten to pick up earlier errors. It says merely amount realized is the cash received and property other than cash received to the extent of its fair market value. That definition has never been distorted or rewritten in order to recover amounts which might have been distorted in previous years. And it should not be done in this case. I would like to mention, however briefly, the implication of the partnership sections. Because in addition to 1001B, there's another section that clearly applies, carefully written by the Congress, and it's Section 752C. It is allegedly a rewriting or a repetition of the Crane rule, and it limits itself to fair market value. Therefore, we believe it must be a description or an enactment of footnote 37. And it says that in the case of a partnership, which is what was involved here, that liabilities shall be deemed to be liabilities of the owner of property where there is no recourse, only to the extent of the value of that property. Now, the tax court below said that clearly the language of this statute covered our situation. They said, however, that the legislative history suggests that the 752C was to apply only in two situations, that is, where property is contributed to a partnership or withdrawn from a partnership. We submit that that kind of result limits Section 752A and B so unnecessarily as to be absolutely ridiculous, because there are other situations in which liabilities of a partnership may increase the basis of partners. For example, this would mean, as was found by the tax court subsequently in the Brontes case, that if a partnership acquires an asset subject to a liability in excess of its basis, that section is not within 752C because it does not involve the contribution of property or the withdrawal of property. And therefore, the partners would get increased basis in a situation like that. Now, that case was reversed subsequently on the grounds that there was no true debt involved. But had there been true debt in a situation like that, the ruling of the tax court below would have destroyed the efficacy of 752C in virtually all situations, other than the contribution and the receipt of properties. We think that we all want a fair and consistent taxing treatment system. We don't believe that the rewriting of two sections of the code, which contain clear and explicit language, that is Section 1001B and Section 752C, so as to recover what the government perceives to be improper earlier deductions, taken at a time when there was no risk, is a proper method of achieving a fair and consistent tax system. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Smith?
Just have a brief point. The taxing system in this particular case, the respondents borrowed $1.8 million. They put it in their pocket, and then they went and bought and constructed this building. The value of the building during their ownership went down to $1.4 million. But then they transferred that property along with the debt. They don't have to worry about the debt anymore, although at one time they had $1.8 million, which they spent. They were not taxed on that. The code gave them basis for that.
Well, you say they don't have to worry about the debt anymore. They never did have to worry about
it. They never had to worry about the debt anymore, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, but at the time, if they wanted to hold on to the property, they had to worry about the debt. Now, they have given the property away. The debt is not their concern, nor is the value of the property their concern. That is the concern, as Justice White pointed out, of the bank, because the bank has to look to the value of the property, which is declined. The respondents... The value of the property has absolutely no relevance to respondents' economic position. If they were to, for example,
buy a piece of land for $1 million subject to a non-recourse mortgage, and then the value of that property would go down to $100,000. They haven't amortized the debt one penny. They then walk away from it. They abandon it. The Court of Appeals would say they have a $900,000 loss because the amount realized is only $100,000. That is, to say the least, absolutely bizarre. As Judge Friendly said
but
in
Mr.
another
Smith, why couldn't, I mean, your opponent says that in Crane, the court read something into the statute that wasn't perfectly clear that was there. Why couldn't the court, in effect, say, well, looking at the code as a whole, a loss is not recognized unless there's an economic detriment? That's his, I understand, his bottom line. Why couldn't we do that?
A loss is not recognized? I mean.
No, a loss is not recognized. You're saying there would be a loss if the fair market value went down and the city
well,
was
that,
not re-
I mean, one can do lots of things. The
well,
point
I mean,
is
it,
that
would
these,
it,
these.
Would it be the, inconsistent with the way the court is
well,
construed
but
the
these
code
statutes
the
mean the same. You know, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. I mean, these statutes mean the same in the gain context as in the loss context. I mean, the statute talks about amount realized less basis equals gain or loss.
Well, is he right in saying there are no cases in which a loss has been recognized for tax purposes without an economic detriment?
I think that's absolutely right. It seems to me that the tax law doesn't give losses without economic detriment. I mean, in this particular case, they had no economic detriment at the end of the transaction. In fact, as Judge Friendly said in another context, any other course would render the concept of basis nonsensical by permitting sellers of mortgage property to register large tax losses stemming from an inflated basis and a diminished realization of gain. We submit that the diminution of the realization of gain executed by the decision below is improper and should be reversed.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Memphis.